American Science. It named the many deep-pocketed donors that have moved into this space in recent years, including Jim Simons. For better or worse, said one analyst in the article, the practice of science in the 21st century is becoming shaped less by national priorities or by peer review groups and more by the particular preferences of individuals with huge amounts of money. The age of grand federal research endeavors, the Times suggested, was winding down as science became a private enterprise. Jim and Marilyn Simons were pleased with the piece because it drew attention to the alarming decline of government funding for science. Jim knew firsthand how important such funding is because he'd gotten his math PhD under a new federal program begun after the Soviets launched Sputnik in 1957. But they thought the Times' claim that American science was becoming privatized was an overreach, given the modest resources of philanthropists compared to those of government. Ironically, the keen awareness among science philanthropists of just how puny they are relative to the feds has lately helped drive their influence to new heights. That's because these funders have zeroed in on where they're likely to make the biggest difference, which is in backing young researchers and those engaged in riskier work. The NIH is a conservative outfit, said Jim Simons. The grants they give are for work that's been mostly done already. They don't want to give you money unless they're pretty darn sure that you're going to succeed. Well, if you're doing great science, maybe you'll succeed and maybe you won't. For people who are thinking well outside the box to do something that's riskier, philanthropic support is much more likely than government support in many cases. The Simonses have sought to operate at this edgy frontier of science. Another funder who thinks the same way is Paul Allen, the Microsoft billionaire who is also among the big science funders to emerge in recent years. Allen has directed hundreds of millions of dollars to risky and experimental research areas, such as artificial intelligence and gene editing. Big chunks of that money could be wasted, or maybe transform life on Earth. Beyond flowing to safe bets, government research funds rarely go to anyone under 40 who doesn't already have a long track record. The result is that for today's younger scientists, private funders have become all-important gatekeepers. Yes, philanthropy only accounts for a fraction of overall science funding, but the balance has been changing. One study charting this shift found that if you factor in endowment income, science philanthropy provides almost 30% of the annual research funds of those in leading universities. That figure offers a window into the growing role of private money in deciding which new ideas and young researchers get support. New talent. The wealthy also play an ever larger role in deciding who lives and who dies. Or, more specifically, which medical problems get conquered versus which are neglected. That ultimate power is not hard to understand. If donors take an interest in a particular disease or condition, moving new money into research, cures are more likely to be found and lives to be saved. Yet the pet health interests of rich people may or may not line up with what society overall should give priority to in seeking medical breakthroughs. As the Times warned, the philanthropists' war on disease risks widening that gap as a number of the campaigns, driven by personal adversity, target illnesses that predominantly afflict white people, like cystic fibrosis, melanoma, and ovarian cancer. Giving for health and medicine is among the most personal areas of philanthropy. Many wealthy donors make huge medical donations because they've had a brush with a particular disease or been helped by a specific hospital. Just look at how Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center has thrived in recent years. Strategically located on the Upper East Side, it caters to some of the wealthiest cancer sufferers in the world, who, in turn, have shown their gratitude. David Koch, who lives in the neighborhood and was treated at Sloan Kettering for prostate cancer, has given it over $200 million. Another Upper East Sider, Henry Kravis, the private equity billionaire, gave $100 million to support Precision Oncology at Sloan Kettering, that taps insights from genomic medicine. Walk around in the vast labyrinth of New York Presbyterian Hospital, located a few blocks from Sloan Kettering, and you'll find one pavilion and specialty center after another named after wealthy donors, some of whom live a short cab ride away. David Koch has also given to this hospital, helping finance an ambulatory care center named after him with a $100 million gift. In turn, that center will be the home of the new Alexandra and Stephen Cohen Hospital for Women and Newborns, paid for by a $75 million gift from the hedge fund billionaire and his wife. Both these operations are housed in the hospital's Weill Cornell campus, named in part after Sanford Weill, a philanthropist who once ran Citigroup. Meanwhile, a few miles north in the Bronx, men have the lowest life expectancy of nearly anywhere in New York State, often dying from causes that could have been prevented if only they had access to basic health care. But helping out the hospitals and health clinics in the city's poor neighborhoods has never been of much interest to wealthy donors. Nor do these donors tend to back work on pedestrian health problems like hypertension, one of the top killers stalking poor black men. Such disparities in health funding make it tempting to settle on another simple storyline about self-serving, elitist philanthropy. As usual, things are more complicated. Many of the biggest health donations that go to name-brand institutions like Sloan Kettering or the Mayo Clinic, another strong money magnet, are for research that can potentially benefit everyone. David Koch's huge gifts for cancer research are a case in point. Koch was drawn to this area after he survived a plane crash in the early 1990s, only to learn at the hospital that he had prostate cancer. He's given millions for this cause, which is a big focus of the research he's backed at Sloan Kettering. Koch has said, "Once you get that disease, you become a crusader to try to cure the disease not only for yourself, but for other people." In the case of prostate cancer, many of those other people are African-American men, who are nearly 1.6 times more likely to get prostate cancer than Caucasian men, and 2.4 times more likely to die from it. The health giving of Herb Sandler, whom we met earlier in the book, also offers a counterpoint to the notion that such philanthropy favors the more affluent. After Sandler and his wife, Marion, grew rich from banking, they didn't give heavily just to progressive causes, like the Center for American Progress and the ACLU. They also began investing in medical research in ways that would have a major effect on poor kids. Marion suffered from severe asthma, which led the couple to research this chronic disease that affects millions of Americans and which can be terrifying. "We wanted to know more about it," Herb told me. The Sandlers learned two things as they dug in. First, that low-income kids of color were among the top sufferers of asthma, which is linked to pollution and cockroaches, both of which are found in abundance in many poor urban areas. The damage to these kids is enormous. Asthma is among the leading reasons that poor kids miss school. They are home with inhalers instead, or in the hospital, at a huge cost to Medicaid. Second, the Sandlers learned that asthma research was a backwater within biomedicine. Very few breakthroughs had been made on asthma in the past half century, and few talented scientists were entering this area. Americans may have been suffering from several million asthma attacks a year, with a few thousand people dying annually, but the world of medical research and health philanthropy didn't seem to much care. The Sandlers set out to change that. They saw a unique opportunity to boost asthma research up into the big leagues and, just maybe, mitigate a health challenge tormenting kids who already had the odds stacked against them. Marion had the unusual thought of injecting big money into the asthma field, but only making grants available to researchers who had never worked on this problem before. It was a wild idea, Herb recalled, for bringing in new blood. It was also an idea that only people with huge financial resources might even have considered, given how much it cost to do medical research. An ordinary person could never imagine using their checkbook to get top-tier MDs and PhDs to shift their career path in a new direction. But billionaires like the Sandlers could imagine that, just as the Simonses, who had even more money, later had the same thought for pushing forward autism research. Still, Marion's idea was risky, and the couple was nervous as their project got underway, soliciting research proposals on asthma from newcomers to the field. "Nobody knew whether it would work," Herb said. All doubts lifted once the applications started rolling in, including many from impressive scientists who'd never worked on asthma. In time, the organization the Sandlers helped start, the American Asthma Foundation, became the largest private funder of asthma research in the United States, as the Sandlers pumped in $100 million that went out as grants. The foundation has brought over 400 new researchers into the field, including at least 36 who made major breakthroughs, such as advances that led to the development of new drugs. Its emergence has helped transform asthma research, with benefits for people of all economic levels. Even greater universal gains may flow from a rising torrent of gifts for brain research. Paul Allen has been a leader here, pumping more than $500 million into the Allen Institute for Brain Science since 2003, but many other donors have followed. The Simons's giving for autism research, which has totaled hundreds of millions of dollars, has mainly sought to understand this complex disorder of brain development. Likewise, much of the $450 million in grants that the Michael J. Fox Foundation has given to cure Parkinson's disease has gone to unlock the workings of the brain. Google co-founder Sergey Brin has been the single largest donor to the foundation, giving it at least $160 million. In late 2015, Chuck Feeney gave $177 million to the University of California, San Francisco, UCSF, for neuroscience research. Just a few months later, Sandy and Joan Weil gave even more for UCSF's brain work, $185 million. Well before these donors came along, Herb and Marion Sandler had given more than $25 million for neuroscience at NCSF. That giving wasn't on par with the Sandlers' backing of work on asthma, but it could have a greater impact, along with all the other money flowing for brain research these days. Why? Because few health challenges will inflict a greater toll on America in the 21st century than the explosive rise of neurodegenerative diseases. Already, the cost of caring for 5 million Americans with Alzheimer's runs more than $250 billion a year, according to one study. Absent new medical breakthroughs, our society would be spending over $1 trillion a year to care for 13 million Alzheimer's sufferers. The global costs will be far higher. When you hear that billionaires like Paul Allen are funding experimental brain research, it can sound like a perfect example of elite philanthropy unmoored from most people's day-to-day concerns. Allen, after all, is the same guy who's spending big for private space travel and also financed the world's largest airplane. His $200 million yacht, Octopus, has a 10-person submarine. In fact, though, backing neuroscience is yet one more way that today's mega-givers may be changing the lives of millions of Americans, in this case, for the better. Campus Cash. The vast money pouring into already wealthy elite universities would seem to offer up a more clear-cut storyline of the upper class feathering its own nests and amplifying its own influence. The gifts to such institutions had become ever larger in recent years and, in some cases, ever harder to justify. Consider the $400 million donation that Nike founder Phil Knight made to Stanford University in early 2016. The money will be used to cover tuition and living expenses for just 100 grad students a year at Stanford, which has one of the largest endowments in the United States, over $20 billion. The idea is to train the next generation of leaders who will go on to address society's most intractable problems, including poverty and climate change. Of course, though, there are plenty of talented leaders who are already in the trenches working on these problems and could sure use some help from the likes of Phil Knight. It's hard to think of Stanford grad students, many of whom already get a tuition-free ride, as a needy bunch. Since 2005, Stanford University, as well as the 8 schools of the Ivy League, have received over 35 gifts of at least $100 million. Stanford received 4 such gifts in 2015 alone. During this same period, state funding for public universities and community colleges has fallen by 20%, according to some estimates, resulting in tuition hikes that put college out of reach for more low-income students. The value of Pell Grants has also been falling for decades. Once, these federal grants for needy students covered most of the cost of attending a public university. Now, they cover just a third of that cost. It's not surprising that the fortunes of elite schools have been soaring. A great many billionaires and multimillionaires have graduated from these schools. Knight got his MBA from Stanford, as did over 20 other billionaires. Harvard Business School has produced at least 64 billionaires, while one analysis found that 3,000 graduates of Harvard College were worth at least $30 million. Now, richer than ever, the alums of wealthy universities are giving back in record-breaking ways. America's universities raised over $40 billion in 2015, with 28% of that money going to just 20 top universities, much of it donated by rich alums. Unfortunately, the ranks of financial winners include few graduates of community colleges, and as a result, big gifts to such institutions are rare. When LaGuardia Community College in New York City received a $2 million donation from Goldman Sachs in 2015, it doubled the school's endowment. The gift was unusual enough to make the New York Times. By comparison, Harvard raised an average of $3.1 million a day during 2015. The richer schools are getting richer. The poor are getting poorer. Three-quarters of the $516 billion in endowment wealth held by U.S. colleges and universities in 2014 was concentrated in the hands of just 11% of schools. These numbers mirror broader inequalities in society. The wealthy get a lot of credit for boosting the fortunes of higher education with their big gifts. But if you look at all their giving, philanthropic and political, the record is mixed. Many donors who give generously to their alma maters also give to conservative politicians and policy groups that have orchestrated cuts to public higher education. John Paulson, the hedge fund billionaire, is a great example. He's been a huge backer of a Republican Party that has repeatedly sought to cut Pell Grants nationally and has cut spending to public universities in the states. Paulson also became, in 2015, the biggest donor in Harvard's history when he made a $400 million gift to the school. That gift, to a university with a $36 billion endowment, could ultimately cost the U.S. Treasury more than $200 million, assuming this money would otherwise have been captured by estate taxes. As it turns out, though, that huge Paulson gift shows why one should be wary of too quickly casting mega-giving to elite universities as another sign of emerging plutocracy. Harvard isn't just a place where the already privileged are groomed to tell everyone else what to do. It also advances research in multiple disciplines, especially science, and has produced 47 Nobel laureates. Harvard spends around $1 billion on research every year, with more than half that money coming from the federal government, and the lion's share going to studies in the life sciences aimed at yielding biomedical breakthroughs. These numbers are a reminder that much of the advanced research that goes on in the United States is conducted at universities. Harvard isn't even a leader in this regard. Johns Hopkins spent $2.2 billion on research in 2014, with the bulk of that money coming from the federal government, and especially the National Institutes of Health. Federal funding for medical research has fared better than most government programs in the past two decades, because Congress is besieged by constituents demanding cures to diseases that kill hundreds of thousands of Americans every year. There's a lobbying group for every major disease you can think of. In contrast, funding for research on engineering, physics, and computational science has far fewer supporters, although breakthroughs in these areas are more likely to produce new inventions that drive economic growth. At most universities, including Harvard, researchers working outside the life sciences are more likely to struggle for funding, especially as the National Science Foundation gets hit with budget cuts. This is where John Paulson's gift came in. The money went to bolster engineering and applied sciences at Harvard. Such research taps the building blocks of basic science, the sort of research backed by the Simons Foundation to invent stuff like nanotechnology, robotics, and artificial intelligence. Paulson's gift was unusual in its size and the ridicule it drew from critics, but otherwise it was similar to many of the largest gifts flowing to elite universities, many of which go to fund research. This has also been the focus of three other top higher education donors of our time, Michael Bloomberg, Gordon Moore, and Chuck Feeney. Bloomberg has given more than $1 billion to Johns Hopkins, with most of that money going for research, including big investments in what became the Bloomberg School of Public Health. One gift of $125 million went to establish the Malaria Research Institute. Another, for $69 million, went to create the Institute for Cell Engineering to advance stem cell research. Yet another massive donation in 2013 endowed 50 distinguished professors, the kind that mainly devote their time to research, not teaching. Gordon Moore, the billionaire co-founder of Intel, has given $700 million to Caltech over the past 15 years, helping turn this small school into one of the world's top research universities. He's been by far the biggest donor to a school that has fewer than 2,400 students, but has produced 34 Nobel laureates. As with other research universities, a steady stream of new inventions and new companies emerge from Caltech every year. Over 2,300 U.S. patents have been issued to Caltech researchers since 1985, and since 1995, 130 startup companies have had their genesis on campus. Chuck Feeney has spread his higher education gifts around more widely, but with a similar focus on research, like that $177 million gift for neuroscience he made to UCSF in 2015. Feeney gave his single biggest gift of $350 million to help finance a new Cornell Science School on Roosevelt Island in New York City. Cornell Tech, as it is called, focuses on a deep inquiry into many of the core disciplines of the digital age, including computer science, electrical engineering, information science, operations research, and business. The new school also landed a $133 million gift from Irwin Jacobs, the founder of Qualcomm, and $100 million from Michael Bloomberg, who, as mayor, championed the idea of turning Roosevelt Island into a tech center. Bloomberg saw his big private gift as helping along a project that would become a huge economic driver for New York, bringing new scientific talent to the city and producing new startups, jobs, and growth. Meanwhile, the generosity of campus givers means that some of the nation's wealthiest schools are now able to offer a free ride to students from lower-income families. That practice was first started by Princeton in 2001. And since then, the school has notably increased the economic diversity of its student body, although, overall, elite schools have made little progress on this front over the past few decades. And while more assistance may be flowing to needy students on these campuses, thanks to philanthropy, such giving also is a way that affluent alums transfer class privilege to their children, helping ensure legacy slots at elite schools that might otherwise go to more gifted students. It gets even worse. As Daniel Golden showed in his book, The Price of Admission, the kids of big donors who aren't alums often receive favorable treatment at admission time. It's no secret that parents with wealth can buy their offspring a big head start in life. Less well known is how tax-deductible philanthropic gifts can be a means to this end. Private money has long played a huge role in higher education. Now that role is growing, and this growth is especially striking at the state level, where there's been a surge of new philanthropic dollars flowing into public universities, even as their state funding has been cut back. Between 1992 and 2010, state appropriations for public research universities dropped from 38% to 23% of the university's total revenues. Along the way, state schools got much better at currying favor with private donors. In 2015, 6 of the top 20 fundraising universities were public schools. In some cases, major donors have stepped forward in recent years to help public universities hit by budget cuts. Giving like this offers reassurance that it isn't just the Princetons pulling in big money these days, as the great wealth boom in recent decades has spread far beyond elite coastal enclaves. Rich people are everywhere, and many have fond memories of their alma maters. Yet anyone who knows how campuses work also knows that donors have influence, especially when their money is viewed as indispensable. Today, America's public universities are being more heavily shaped by the wealthy than at any time since these institutions were created. That clout can play out in troubling ways. At the University of Virginia, a cabal of wealthy donors forced out the school's president, Teresa Sullivan, in 2012, causing an uproar. She was later reinstated, but the underlying conditions that made the failed coup possible haven't changed. In 1990, the Virginia state government provided about a quarter of the university's budget. 2 decades later, that proportion had dwindled to under 7%, which meant the school relied far more on the goodwill of major private donors, donors who often have strong opinions as to how a public university founded by Thomas Jefferson should be run. In another case documented by the Los Angeles Times, major donors to the University of Illinois reportedly pressured the school's leadership in 2014 to fire a professor, Stephen Salida, for a series of provocative tweets on Israel and Gaza. You can see why the university's officials might be so attuned to private donors, given that the Illinois university system has faced punishing cuts in public funding that began well before the 2008 recession. Between 2002 and 2015, state appropriations for higher education in Illinois fell by 20%. Public universities in Michigan have also been hit by spending cuts in recent years, including Wayne State in Detroit. Between 2011 and 2016, with fiscal conservatives led by GOP Governor Rick Snyder in total control of Michigan's government, the school had been forced to accept $75 million in budget cuts. That battering may explain why leaders at Wayne State University in Detroit eagerly accepted a $40 million gift in 2015 from a wealthy local couple that came with controversial strings attached. Among other things, the donors were given input on the curriculum and strategic plan of the university's business school, as well as aspects of the educational experience. In his book, Unmaking the Public University, Christopher Newfield documents the rising influence of private donors over state schools since the 1980s, and what it's meant to have these schools increasingly catering to the preferences and sometimes the narrow-minded whims of powerful outside figures. The cloud of donors on campus has risen in conjunction with that of corporations, which have also come to exercise new influence on campus through research funding and contracting, as Jennifer Washburn documented in her 2006 book, University Incorporated, The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. Some philanthropists have seen campus donations as a way to try to shape the ideology of students and the direction of academic research. After the so-called Powell Memo of 1971 called on businesses to challenge liberalism on campuses, the Olin and Bradley Foundations, both started by wealthy industrialists, poured money into campus work to promote free market ideas. They underwrote research centers, endowed professorships, and graduate scholarships. Charles Koch is another funder that moved aggressively to fund on campuses. In 2014 alone, his foundation directed $27 million in grants to some 300 universities to back libertarian ideas that stress the virtues of markets and the downsides of government. Koch has been interested in these ideas all his adult life. In his 20s, after graduating from MIT, he read lots of political theory at night while working as an energy consultant. He was deeply influenced by writers such as Friedrich Hayek and Michael Polanyi. He started making donations to think tanks and academic centers as early as the 1960s, and has so far channeled at least $200 million to universities alone. That's a big stream of funding, but Koch has said he plans to expand such giving down the line. State schools have been among the biggest beneficiaries of Koch largesse, which has occasionally caused controversy. Florida State University was embroiled in a flap after it was alleged in 2011 that a Koch grant had come with stipulations about what faculty could be hired and fired by the school's economics department. The controversy caused a stir and made national news, but it didn't dampen FSU's willingness to take $800,000 in additional Koch grants in 2016. Far bigger sums are flowing to other schools, like Montana State University, which landed a Koch $5.7 million grant the same year to fund research critical of government regulation. It's not uncommon for donors to make various demands in return for campus cash. In one case, the foundation of BB&T Bank offered $1 million for business education to Western Carolina University, a public state school in Cullowhee, North Carolina. Among the reported stipulations of the gift was that the university's College of Business make Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand required reading for students. The school took the money. This was not an isolated episode. The donor behind the offer, John Allison, the former chairman of BB&T and later the president of the Cato Institute, had offered similar deals to at least 63 schools going back over a decade. After Guilford College accepted a $500,000 grant with little consultation with faculty, a professor there wrote, "This deal with BB&T was simply an egregious case of the college administration deciding to sell a chunk of the curriculum." Allison framed his goals in terms strikingly similar to how Lewis Powell had in 1971, as a pushback against the pervasive liberal orthodoxy on campuses. "It's really a battle of ideas," he told a reporter. "If the ideas that made America great aren't heard, then their influence will be destroyed." Allison said in 2011 that he hoped to extend his grants to 200 schools by 2015. BB&T claimed that it was no longer making such grants. Meanwhile, plenty of liberal donors also bankroll campus work. Williams Institute at UCLA's law school, initially underwritten by Chuck Williams and then backed by other top LGBT funders like Tim Gill, played a key role in formulating the legal ideas behind the quest for marriage equality and other anti-discrimination efforts. Thomas Piketty's treatise on inequality, Capital in the 21st Century, was partly informed by research done at the Center for Equitable Growth at the University of California at Berkeley, which has been supported by Herb Sandler, among other donors. Sandler has funded a similar institute in Washington, D.C., that makes grants to academics who are exploring how to reduce inequality and boost growth. A research outfit fueled with $75 million from George Soros and tech leader Jim Balsillie, the Institute for New Economic Thinking, has been backing economists in the United States and around the world to challenge free market fundamentalism. The hedge fund billionaire Tom Steyer has donated millions for campus work on clean energy and climate change. Separately, through his Next Gen Climate Organization, Steyer has given money to register college students to vote. In short, higher education is yet one more venue where more philanthropists are giving more money than ever in an effort to shape the direction of U.S. society. Given the size of the federal budget, which totaled around $4 trillion in 2016, you might think that elected leaders would have plenty of leeway to increase spending on things like science, the arts, and education. Yet only about a quarter of the federal budget can be used in such discretionary ways, and far less if you don't count defense spending. The rest is committed by law to mandatory outlays, chiefly for entitlements like Medicare and Social Security, but also to pay interest on the national debt. This mandatory spending is projected to grow dramatically in the next few decades as the boomers retire and more debt payments come due. Budget analysts say that without big changes in current policies, federal mandatory spending will equal 21% of GDP by 2046, which is as much as all federal spending in recent years. The squeeze on discretionary outlays will only grow more intense as time goes on. Even a major boost in revenue through higher taxes along with entitlement reform, both of which would be heavy lifts in a polarized Washington, D.C., may do little to lessen that squeeze. We're likely to see the steady shrinking of a pot of money that goes to not only science, education, and the arts, but also to NASA, the EPA, housing and community development, infrastructure, national parks, the Department of Energy, and so on. Already, according to one analysis, the share of national income going to these programs is rapidly approaching the lowest level, measured as a share of the economy, in at least 5 decades. The upshot is that we're moving into an era in which dreamers, who want to see big advances in areas like the arts, science, and higher education, often feel they should be talking to people like Elon Musk, Paul Allen, or Alice Walton, the billionaires who actually have the resources to make stuff happen. When philanthropists step into the breach left by a hollowed-out public sector, one reflex is to feel gratitude. I certainly felt that way, for example, when Jim Simons told me the story of how he had sounded the alarm for years about the decline of U.S. math education, an area he knew well, only to be ignored by Washington. Finally, he started funding a new program with his own money, Math for America, which now draws some state funding. That's obviously a good deed, and just as obviously, it's troubling that it takes the wealth of a private citizen to tackle a problem that affects the entire U.S. economy. The new mega-givers are not the villains in this story. Simons and other high-minded donors like him are coming along at a very fortuitous moment, and we should indeed be thankful as more of them step forward. Most are just trying to do a good thing, but as their power grows, so too must the scrutiny grow of how that power is used, along with the larger changes in U.S. society that are acting to amplify that power. Chapter 11. Agents of Wealth. In the 1985 movie Brewster's Millions, Richard Pryor played a bewildered heir who has to spend $30 million in 30 days in order to inherit a fortune 10 times that size. Brewster gets to work, moving into a luxurious hotel suite and hiring staff at exorbitant rates. But he finds the job is much harder than he thought, especially after he accidentally makes his pile of money even bigger from business investments. Any number of philanthropists have learned the same lesson that Brewster did in the movie. Giving away large amounts of money isn't easy. And the more money you have, the tougher it is to get rid of. Let's say you have $10 billion, one donor told me, and you stick it in municipal funds that earn 3%. That's still $300 million a year you're making. Of course, many wealthy investors make much higher returns, and any number of billionaire philanthropists have seen their fortunes rise by huge leaps in the past decade. Giving away lots of money is especially hard for donors who are gunning to make systemic changes in society and aren't interested in tossing big chunks of wealth overboard by writing 9-figure checks to Harvard or the Met. If you want to have that deeper kind of influence with your money, you need a strong vision and strategy. You need to find the right leverage points and identify the best people to invest in. Few major philanthropists can do this alone. They need help, which often means building a foundation. Much has been written about the American Foundation since it was invented over a century ago. One way to think about such institutions, at least early in their life cycle, when the original donor is still alive, is that they are incomparable vehicles for amplifying the influence that wealthy private citizens can have over society. You don't fully appreciate this until you walk around a foundation created by a living donor and see rows of offices filled with people working to advance that person's vision. It's hard for most of us to imagine hiring dozens or hundreds of professional staff to carry out any grand ideas we may have for reshaping society. Bill and Melinda Gates now have some 1,400 people working at their foundation. Yet the super wealthy are setting up new institutions like this all the time, with enough money to hire top executives and experts from different fields. That's another thing unfathomable to most of us, that we could have former university presidents or cabinet secretaries or award-winning scientists on our own payroll. Major philanthropists aren't just empowering themselves, they are empowering those who work for them, people who suddenly find themselves in charge of big resources that can be used to make things happen. These new agents of wealth have a unique kind of power, insulated from the whims of voters or shareholders, even as they wield influence on a par with some elected officials and corporate CEOs. Foundation executives and program officers have long been familiar figures in the nonprofit world. Most have typically worked at legacy operations, where the original donor is long gone. And while that remains true today in raw numbers, more of these people now work for living donors who are involved in a hands-on way. Paradigm shift. When wealthy people first get involved in philanthropy, they often spend time floundering around. They tend to give reactively, as Jim and Marilyn Simons did at first. They put money here and there, they get advice from different people, they experiment. "We just sort of noodled it out ourselves," Jim said about the early years of the Simons Foundation. Some philanthropists never move past this stage. Their giving may remain pretty informal even as the dollar amounts get bigger and bigger, and some actively resist institutions that could become bureaucracies, as the hedge fund billionaire Bruce Kovner put it. Other philanthropists, though, find themselves hankering for more help getting money out the door in a smart way. They start looking for somebody who can turn a grab bag of giving into a real philanthropic operation, one that is focused and strategic. For the Simonses, that person, and a paradigm shift, came in the form of Gary Fishbach, the research veteran who knew how to deploy money in search of scientific breakthroughs. For John and Laura Arnold, it was Dennis Calabrese. Calabrese first met John Arnold at an event on education in 2010 and later got to talking to the couple about funding in this area. What became clear to me is that they were dissatisfied with investments in education which were not going to produce systemic change, Calabrese told me. They weren't jazzed by the idea of building one charter or even 10 charter schools. They were wondering if there was a way to do something more lasting and systemic. The Arnolds had started their foundation 2 years earlier, and their giving was pretty uncomplicated. They were big supporters of KIPP charter schools and among the biggest backers of the Houston Food Bank. But when they met Calabrese, they were already starting to think more strategically and ambitiously about philanthropy, with an eye on grant-making that could foster permanent changes. "I don't think they had terminology for it. They just had this instinct," said Calabrese. Calabrese has a diverse background. He'd gone to Rice University in Houston and then been drawn into politics. "I wanted to change the world," he said. Calabrese worked in Congress, eventually becoming chief of staff to Republican Representative Dick Armey in the 1990s. He grew jaded on Capitol Hill, coming to believe that Beltway politics was not the way to change the world. So he returned to Texas and became a consultant, working with a range of clients, both corporate and nonprofit, on policy and communications. He became adept at pulling different levers of power, from lobbying and grassroots advocacy to litigation and advertising campaigns. Often, he was a hired gun for business clients fighting regulation or prosecution. When Enron collapsed in 2001, Calabrese led the PR effort for ex-CEO Jeffrey Skilling, serving as his spokesman. Skilling would later be convicted on federal felony charges related to Enron's demise. There are no standard qualifications for becoming a foundation president. While some such leaders emerge from the inside, after years climbing upward in foundations, the majority are recruited from outside philanthropy. Calabrese had never worked in a foundation, but he knew this universe. Some of his clients over the years had been foundations and major donors, and usually he was the guy telling these funders to think more strategically. What he liked about the Arnolds is that they already got it, and the couple and Calabrese began a series of conversations about how they could focus their giving more sharply to advance systemic changes. One criteria for such change, the three agreed, was that it would have to be scalable so that it could have a large impact on society. Another is that it would have to be sustainable to endure without ongoing philanthropic support. The next big question, though, was how the Arnolds should pursue this goal. Was a traditional grant-making foundation even the right vehicle? And if it was, would it be possible to assemble a group of people who would think about things in a more structural way as opposed to an incremental way? These conversations led to Calabrese being named the first president of the Arnold Foundation in September 2010. He also became the third member of its board. Tightly held governance is not uncommon for foundations, even big ones. The Gates Foundation has just four trustees, William Gates Sr., Bill, Melinda, and Warren Buffett. In the early 20th century, when John D. Rockefeller was petitioning Congress for a charter to create the first foundation, a top nonprofit leader of that time, Edward Devine, argued the charter should only be granted if public officials had some say over the selection of board members. The idea never went anywhere and has rarely been raised since. Foundations answer only to themselves. With Calabrese in place as president, the Laura and John Arnold Foundation began to take shape. Within a year, it had a growing staff and swanky new offices in an office tower in downtown Houston. "I'm not the person who figures out what the ideas are," Calabrese said about what he brought to this effort. "I'm the one who, if you tell me what the status quo is and where you're trying to get to, I try to figure out the strategy to get there, the communications needs, and all the other stuff." As the new president of the Arnold Foundation, Calabrese saw his job as advancing the overall goal of systemic change, while other senior staff brought expertise in specific issues. 3 years into the job, he was making nearly $700,000. That level of pay is common for the head of a mid-sized foundation, and arguably quite generous for running an entity with no real bottom line, no competition, and no fear of ever going bankrupt. On the other hand, as the philanthropy expert Faye Twersky has written, after interviewing dozens of foundation CEOs, these jobs are harder than they look. Such executives must be able to tend to their board of directors, to manage their organization internally, and to drive their foundation to make an impact externally. By their own reckoning, few CEOs are equally successful in all three domains. After John Arnold closed his hedge fund, he and Laura were both in the office all the time. The Arnolds see their active role as an advantage. "It allows the staff to take more risks, ironically," John told me. "Foundations get very conservative after the founder passes, and you have a professional staff that answers to a third-party board." He went on, "Our role is to push the staff to take risks. We'll sign off on it. So whenever we have projects that aren't successful, we'll have our name on it too. So it's not, you're fired, it's, okay, that didn't work. Let's add that to the feedback loop and figure out how to do this better next time." When he was managing a hedge fund, Arnold's job was to carefully monitor the risk-taking of his traders, to make sure that hungry staff paid on commission didn't get reckless in their pursuit of big gains. "On the foundation side, it's the opposite," he said. "There are few big upsides to risk-taking in a grant-making environment for staff, in terms of rewards, but some obvious downsides if things go wrong." Along with Calabrese, the Arnolds wanted to ensure a different dynamic, one in sync with their belief that philanthropy should think big, take risks, and be aggressive and highly goal-oriented. As the Arnold Foundation expanded, it was soon staffed with a core group of experts. philanthropists have a major edge in recruiting talent, offering salaries higher than what nonprofits or academic institutions pay. The biggest allure for those joining foundations is having the resources to help advance causes they care about. The initial focus was education, criminal justice, and pension reform, issues that the Arnolds were already interested in before Calabrese came along. But the agenda quickly expanded to include other issues, including health care, scientific integrity, and inequality. The foundation opened an office in New York City and eventually one in Washington. More staff were hired. In 2012, the foundation gave out $40 million. In 2014, it gave out $85 million. In 2015, it gave out $185 million. Foundation expansion can take on a momentum of its own once more senior staff start to come on board. With new people come new ideas for doing more things and giving away more money. Initiatives proliferate along with people to carry them out. Was the growth of the Arnold Foundation an example of what many donors, like Bruce Kovner, fear? That staff would create their own agenda with a result of mission drift? Calabrese didn't think so. The expanding agenda had its own logic, he said, which was pretty simple. As we learned more and talked to more people, we started to get interested in other areas. Philanthropists with ambitious, complex goals for influencing society are likely to feel the strongest need to build up major foundations. If you're trying to achieve breakthroughs in science, as the Simonses are, you need expert help. The same is true if you're on a quest for paradigm-shifting solutions to stubborn public policy problems, as the Arnolds are. Although, even as their foundation added staff, it remained lean compared to some older foundations that, over time, have developed ever more infrastructure. Then there's a donor such as Bill Ackman, who, like the Arnolds, is looking for the big score impact-wise with his philanthropy, but has still resisted creating much of an infrastructure. Ackman does his giving with the help of just a few staff working at his hedge fund offices overlooking Central Park in Manhattan. He echoed Kovner's fear that foundations can become horrible bureaucracies. Ackman's day job involves managing billions of dollars and making frequent bets that hinge on understanding complex issues and data. The key to success, he believes, isn't having staff studying things to death, but asking the right questions to see whether an idea and the person behind it can succeed. "I don't think overhead is particularly productive," he told me. Eli Broad is another philanthropist with large ambitions who hasn't built a large organization. "I don't believe in huge staffs," he said. One reason he cited is that it's easier for a donor to shift direction, pulling the plug on certain lines of grant-making, if you don't have to deal with internal constituencies. Quite a few other top philanthropists who've emerged in the past decade or two think the same way, including Herb Sandler, who's hired few staff at the Sandler Foundation, even as it gives tens of millions of dollars away every year. Sandler talks about the formula for high-impact philanthropy in ways similar to Ackman. It's all about betting big on the right people, working the right leverage points with the right ideas. Like many new philanthropists who focus their giving narrowly and strategically, Sandler tends to scratch his head at how many big legacy foundations operate. Slicing and dicing their grant-making budgets across hundreds of nonprofits, most of which never achieve the scale that's needed to have impact. In fact, that approach is really not so surprising at foundations with large program staff who develop their own agendas, forming attachments to certain work and grantees. Also, when a foundation has a lot of staff, each with their own pet interests and professional networks, more nonprofits have routes to land a grant, as well as an ally inside to defend that grant at renewal time. There are good reasons that newer philanthropists worry about creating bureaucracies. Many top philanthropists don't have foundations at all. Sanford Weill and Denny Stanford, for example, have both given away over $1 billion without much help from permanent staff. a proliferation of consulting firms, along with full-service donor-advised funds and intermediaries like New Profit, makes it easier than ever to engage in large-scale grant-making without building up a foundation of one's own. On the other hand, some lean funders have run into big problems with their approach. Ackman put $25 million into the bid to reform Newark schools based on a pitch from Cory Booker. He believed in Booker and saw the bet as about investing in a person. Some better staffing might have been helpful here. The Arnold's operation, as it evolved, landed in between the poles of bureaucratic and lean. It's a substantial organization, yet one determined to remain nimble and to keep up the momentum. This is not a foundation designed to exist in perpetuity. The Arnold's goal, along with so many younger donors, is to give away all their money while they're still living. Immortal influence. Plenty of living donors still favor traditional foundations that have limitless lifespans and embrace an ethos of stewardship. Amos and Barbara Hostetter are a case in point. They are part of the Boston Brahmin elite, or what's left of it, a world that frowns on big egos and brash pronouncements. Amos attended a prestigious private school before going on to Amherst and Harvard, and then making his fortune in cable television. Barbara became a pillar of Boston's nonprofit world, sitting on multiple boards. The couple live in a mansion on stately Beacon Hill and embrace a more restrained vision of how philanthropists should operate. They aren't in a rush to deploy their multi-billion dollar fortune in an urgent push for systemic change. Rather, they have aimed to endow a foundation that will exist in perpetuity, providing a steady flow of resources to improve life in Boston and New England. The Hostetters started their Barr Foundation in 1987 and for years moved slowly in their giving. That pace is common for many older donors who accumulate their wealth over decades and, as they age, gradually ramp up their philanthropy. An advantage of this approach is that there's plenty of time for trial and error. "We didn't start with being the smartest people in the room," Barbara once said. "We knew we had a good learning curve ahead of us." For many years, the Hostetters kept their giving anonymous, quietly becoming one of the biggest funders in Boston as they funneled grants to the arts, education, and more. Even after they went public with their giving, the foundation kept things quiet, with a modest staff overseen by low-key executive directors who reported to the couple. But the foundation steadily grew in size, adding more staff and programs. By 2013, it had assets of $1.6 billion, making it the biggest foundation in New England. Barr became more influential in Boston as its money flowed everywhere. It was among the city's biggest private funders of education, as well as the arts. In 2010, emerging from behind the scenes, it announced a $50 million initiative to reduce carbon emissions by backing work on energy efficiency and public transportation. All the while, Amos Hostetter cultivated other levers of influence as a mover and shaker in local business circles, as well as a campaign donor and advisor to politicians. He and Barbara were prototypical super citizens. The Hostetters' path to influence may have been low-key and modest, they rarely spoke to the media, but it was highly effective. Among other things, their wide power network made it easier for the Barr Foundation to do things in collaboration with partners, such as city government or other foundations. Barr would come to forge an especially close relationship with the Klarman Family Foundation, a more recent arrival to Boston philanthropy, which is piloted by the hedge funder Seth Klarman and his wife Beth, who share the Hostetters' keen interest in the local arts. In 2013, Boston Magazine ranked Amos and Barbara Hostetter among the 25 most powerful people in the city. At some point, the couple decided it was time to take their foundation to the next level. For all the money they'd given to Barr, they had even more sitting on the sidelines, another $3 billion or so. While they never commented on their plans for that wealth, the foundation was an obvious destination, assuming it had the capacity to handle such an expansion. the Hostetters began to scout around for a top-tier executive to run Barr. One candidate who emerged was Jim Canales, then president of the James Irvine Foundation in California. Canales, still in his 40s, had spent almost his entire career at Irvine. He'd ascended the ranks quickly at the foundation, a top regional funder, becoming its CEO in 2009.